I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Spaniards awoke today to the prospect of a new government. Yesterday's national elections provided an upset. The ruling Popular Party tumbled from power, replaced by the socialists, with analysts pointing to one clear cause: last week's terrorist attacks, which killed 200. The attacks are seen as the price Spaniards have paid for a war they did not want. 90% of Spaniards objected to Prime Minister Aznar's support of the war. Joining us from Madrid is Charles Sennett, correspondent for the Boston Globe. And Charlie, you were there before the elections. Can you actually tell that people changed their votes because of the bombings?
Yes. You could hear that on the street, that, yeah, 90% of the country was against the war in Iraq, but, you know, this election was going to be about the economy, stupid. And it really was about Spain having a surging economy, and Aznar's Popular Party being able to take credit for that was almost guaranteeing his party re-election. And, you know, then there was this horrific bombing on Thursday, 200 people killed, four commuter trains packed with mostly working class people coming in from the outlying suburbs. And this country went into one of the most dramatic weeks in its modern history. I mean, the concussion blasts, you know, from that bomb just rolled right over and kind of blew up all the conventional wisdom on what was going to happen in this election and resulted in an upset victory for the Socialist Party.
Well, and the leader of the Socialist Party had been pledging during his election campaign that Spanish troops would only stay in Iraq if the occupation there, the American-led occupation, won the backing of the UN and the rest of the international community. What is he saying today?
Today he's saying very clearly that he's going to pull the Spanish troops out of Iraq on June 30th. But there's something that's really important to understand and to kind of get your head around in this, and that is that these are two very different tracks, I think. You know, one is the war in Iraq. That doesn't mean, however, that they're going to give up on the war in terror, because it's very important to also point out that Spain has been really on the cutting edge of going after al-Qaeda in Europe. They've had a lot of arrests and prosecutions here. There's a high court judge here who's the chief judge in the counterterrorism effort, who's been very strident, very aggressive, very smart in fighting the war on terror. No one's talking about stopping that, neither the Socialist Party nor the Right of Center Party. And it's interesting to point out that Zapatero, the leader of the newly elected Socialist Party, is not talking about pulling Spanish troops out of Afghanistan. So there's an ability here in Spain to see these two issues as very separate. Many people see the war in Iraq not as part of the war on terror, but as something that undercut the war on terror.
Charlie, just quickly, let's touch on the investigation. Because of backpacks, cell phones, vans, tapes that were found, investigators seem pretty sure that this is either al-Qaeda or a group that's inspired by al-Qaeda.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the idea, that this is an Islamic extremist cell of some kind that, despite a tremendous effort on the part of the Spanish authorities to crack down on al-Qaeda in Spain, managed to settle itself in a kind of poor, crowded immigrant barrio in Madrid. And they think it is in that neighborhood from which this cell was able to carry out this bombing. But that cell and how we understand it is going to be really important. Yes, all facts are pointing towards some kind of al-Qaeda connection, but I think from what we're hearing from investigators, more likely a group inspired by al-Qaeda than one directly linked to the organization. Very early, hard to say so far. A lot of twists and turns could come in this, but I think that seems to be the general direction of the investigators right now.
Charlie, thank you.
Thank you.
Charles Sennett, correspondent for the Boston Globe, speaking to us from Madrid.
Well, does the fall of Spain's ruling Popular Party to the socialists reverberate politically in Washington? We turn to Andrea Stone now, Washington correspondent for USA Today. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Bill.
Andrea, is there domestic U.S. political fallout as a result of the attack in Madrid?
I think people are interpreting this as a real blow to the Bush administration. I mean, after all, Spain really went out on a limb to support us in the Iraq War, despite 90% of Spaniards in their polls showing they were against getting involved in Iraq. So, you know, this has got to be making the Bush administration really think twice. This is the first government to really basically fall because of terrorism, if you make that connection.
The Bush's sometimes troubled relationship with the UN comes to the fore again. How do you expect the administration will react, Andrea, to Prime Minister-elect José Luis Zapatero's demand for a UN resolution supporting the Iraqi transitional government? He wants that resolution or he pulls the troops out?
I don't think that the administration has been really excited about that resolution. I don't think it's going to be going anywhere. And frankly, unless that changes, I think the Spanish troops will leave at the end of June. But, you know, they really are token. I mean, there's 1,300 troops there. But obviously, any withdrawal from an ally has got to hurt. I just wanted to mention that the new socialist leader of Spain said today that he's hoping to restore Spain's, quote, magnificent ties to Germany and France, which had been strained over the war in Iraq. And he was asked about relations with the U.S., and he said he was hoping to have, quote, cordial relations with the U.S. So I think there's a real difference in approach to the Bush administration there.
Andrea, what impact do you think this has on the American public? For example, the American public that's getting on trains today.
Well, I think commuters getting going to work this morning are going to be looking around. You know, this morning, Asa Hutchinson, who is Undersecretary of Homeland Security, said he thought al-Qaeda was involved in the Spanish attack. And he also said that it's just impossible to have the kind of security that you see at airports on the subways and rail lines. And already the Democrats are saying, you know, that the Bush administration has not given enough money to Homeland Security. So they're already talking about that. I think another point that is going to make people worried, I mean, we're still 8 months out from our own election, but, you know, this bombings in Spain came just before the election and changed the results of the election. And people have got to be thinking about, are we going to have something like this in November or before November? You know, the old October surprise.
Vice President Dick Cheney, in the wake of the bombing, said this about John Kerry's position on terrorism. He's embraced the strategy of the 1990s, which holds that when we are attacked, we ought to round up those directly responsible, put them on trial, and then call it a day.
You know, I think John Kerry has to be careful. We're talking about a terrorist attack that killed over 200 people, and you don't want to sort of make political hay out of it, but of course you do. you know, I mean, even before this, you know, John Kerry had said that he had talked to foreign leaders who were just waiting. You know, they were really hoping that he could beat President Bush because they didn't like President Bush. And yesterday in Pennsylvania, he was even called on this and, you know, tell us who these people were. Of course, he demurred and he wouldn't say. But, you know, I think right now the economy and jobs are going to be the issues that have been pushing this campaign so far. But this explosion in Spain and the changing government there might bring the topic back to Iraq again.
Andrea Stone is Washington correspondent for USA Today. Thanks, Andrea.
Thank you, Bill.
A large order of high-speed electrical switches from a Salem, Massachusetts manufacturing plant recently ended up in Islamabad, Pakistan. The sale also resulted in the arrest of an Israeli businessman, touched off an investigation into the international black market for nuclear devices, and brings home the difficulty of the war on terror. The switches are purchased in small numbers for hospital use, but large orders of the devices can be used to detonate nuclear bombs. Farrah Stockman is covering the story for the Boston Globe. She joins us from Washington. Welcome.
Thanks a lot.
Now, this company in Salem, Massachusetts, they were suspicious of this order of switches, but the feds were already looking into an order of switches. Can you sort of summarize how these switches ended up in Islamabad?
Yeah, these switches are used in hospitals, so it's legal to sell them. It's legal to sell them even abroad, but it's not legal to sell them to certain countries. They were sent through this middleman, Asher Carney, an Israeli businessman based in South Africa, who ordered them from the United States, managed to send them to Pakistan to his client. Someone in South Africa tipped off the U.S. government that these were going to go on to Pakistan. Meanwhile, the order came in to the company in Salem, and it was the largest order they'd ever received. Mm-hmm. There were 200 ordered, whereas an average hospital would only need about 5. So the company was suspicious.
We understand that when they're ordered by hospitals, they're used to break up kidney stones and the like.
Yep.
But the fact that they were sent to Pakistan, traveling through other countries along the way, raised real fears because, of course, we now know that Pakistan is the hub of nuclear black market trading.
Yes, actually, Pakistan is the center of an investigation into nuclear proliferation into Iran, North Korea, and Libya.
And this is the world of dual-use technology, in other words, marketed for one thing but perhaps used for more nefarious things. What was the thinking that these switches would be used for?
They're essentially triggers. They send a high-speed electrical impulse, and you need those triggers to set off a nuclear bomb. And if any country that wants to test a nuclear weapon has to have a steady supply of these things.
How big a black market is there for this kind of technology?
It's really hard to tell. I think that any country that has a secret nuclear program has to find a way to get it, and they buy it on the black market. I think the fear is not only that countries are buying these things and developing nuclear weapons, but also possibly individuals. Mm. When we go into countries like Libya and Iran and get surprised by the progress that they've made towards building a nuclear weapon, that progress could only be possible by having a healthy black market.
We should say that some of the employees of PerkinElmer Incorporated of Salem, Massachusetts, the makers of the switches, they worked with federal agents. How often does that happen, do we know?
The fines on companies are pretty heavy for selling dual-use technology and having it end up in the wrong hands. So most companies that are reputable, like PerkinElmer, employ someone full-time to look at the orders that come in and examine, you know, whether or not they're being placed by credible people. And the United States actually might send someone to a hospital and find out if the hospital still has the product in the case of these switches. So there are controls.
Asher Carney, the middleman, was accused of purchasing these switches for a Pakistani businessman who, as you write, counts the Pakistani military among his clients. What has happened to him?
Nothing. Nothing at all. The Pakistani middleman is giving interviews in Islamabad. He basically denies that he bought the switches, but says, yeah, I do business with Asher Carney all the time. Nothing will happen to him because if he's a supplier of Pakistan's military, the government in Pakistan is not going to punish him.
Well, shades of the recent story of the Pakistani nuclear scientist who was pretty much not punished for admitting that he'd been selling nuclear secrets to other countries.
Yeah, not only was A.Q. Khan not punished, he was not even asked to give the money back. He made untold millions on selling secrets and has been allowed to keep his money.
Well, Farah Stockman, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Farah Stockman, a reporter with the Boston Globe. For more on her article, go to our website, here-now.org.
And this note, explosives experts in Karachi, Pakistan, defused a bomb planted in a van outside the U.S. consulate about 4 minutes before it was set to explode. This just days before Secretary of State Colin Powell is set to arrive in Pakistan, though he's not going to Karachi. 2 years ago, a suicide bomber blew up a truck outside the consulate, killing several Pakistanis.
Just ahead, the rich and taxes. Do they pay their fair share? We'll talk to a journalist who's run the numbers.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
How fair is the tax system? April 15th will be here before you know it, and we'll all be asked to pay our fair share. Do some, though, find ways to get a better deal than others? Joining us on the line is David K. Johnston. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times and author of the book, Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else. Welcome, David.
Thank you for having me on, Bill.
David, you believe the injustice in the tax system is primarily about a group you call the super rich. Who are they? How much money are we talking about?
Our national myth is that the super rich, people who make millions of dollars a year, that group is heavily taxed to benefit everybody else. It turns out when you get into the subject deeply, you find out that that's not the case, that for many years, the tax burden on the top 1/10 of 1% of Americans, the top 1/100 of 1%, the top 400 Americans has been falling, and everybody else's tax burden has been going up.
How come?
we have this enormous shift in burden, shifting the burden of taxes off of people who make millions of dollars a year and onto people who make $30,000 to about $500,000 a year. So that's the middle class and the upper middle class.
Well, it is true, isn't it, that federal tax receipts as a share of national income are at the lowest level since 1950, though taxes on the middle class, especially the payroll taxes, are at historic highs. That declines have come primarily from taxes paid by the top 5%.
That's exactly correct. But it's really the top 5% starts at about $100,000, and it goes all the way up to billions of dollars. The real beneficiaries at the very top. Let me give you a concrete example. In 1993, the 400 highest income people in America, according to an IRS report, paid 30 cents on the dollar in federal income taxes. By 2000, they were down to paying 22 cents on the dollar on an average income of $174 million each. And I calculate that if the Bush cuts had been in effect, they would have paid 17.5 cents on the dollar. Now, you can add Social Security into that group, and it doesn't change the numbers one bit. Everybody else in America went from paying 13 cents on the dollar in federal income taxes up to 15 cents in the year 2000. Most Americans paid a lot more of their income to the federal government than the super rich.
David, you write about a gentleman named Jonathan Blotmacher, who's a partner at Milbank, Tweed, Hadley, and McCloy. Tell us about him and how he helps the super rich to keep their money.
Jonathan Blotmacher is so famous among tax lawyers that if you simply say his first name, they know who you're talking about. He is an incredibly smart guy who has figured out one way or after another to slip dollars around the tax code. And people pay lots of money for the various devices he comes up with. In many of them, they've stood the test of time, but many others have been so aggressive that once the government finds out about them, they shut them down. I reported on one of his devices 2 years ago in the New York Times, and it took the government exactly 18 days to issue orders disallowing what he was doing. But people had put up individually, in many cases, over $100 million to buy life insurance policies using this very complicated technique, which is so complicated your head would explode on trying to understand it, to get around paying income, gift, and estate taxes.
Part of it's kind of almost a game for him. Number one, he wants to do everything legally, and the challenge is to find the loophole for him.
That's exactly right, and to find the one that no one else could see. And in his mind, it's perfectly okay, and in fact, as a matter of law, it's perfectly okay to arrange your affairs to pay the lowest possible tax, and that's what he does for people. He's just very aggressive and very creative, and he puts together, out of all the complexity of the tax code, loopholes that nobody else can imagine because he's such a smart guy.
And he found a loophole that would allow the super rich not to pay any capital gains, and he made Congress aware of it.
Well, yes, he and I independently discovered this, and then we talked, and because I can't quote myself, I quoted him. But when President Bush, who during the campaign said he would cut taxes but wouldn't give us any specifics, introduced his tax cut bill a few days after he took office, Jonathan and I independently read the bill and immediately realized that there was an enormous, subtle tax giveaway in it because we were going to repeal the gift tax. That's what prevents someone who's very wealthy from giving away all their money on their deathbed to avoid the estate tax. And we were going to retain the principle that inheritors receive whatever property they get as if it was fully taxed, and it's known as a step-up in basis. Well, if you combine those two things together, the following is made possible. Let's go back to that stock you bought for a dollar that's worth $100 million, and if you sell it, you'll have to pay capital gains taxes. Now you give it to your aunt, who's in her 80s, in a trust, and when she dies, it comes back to you. It's now worth $100 million for tax purposes. You sell it, you don't owe any tax. And after this was written about, the White House said, well, you know, we'll look into this. We don't think that there's any problem with this bill. Congress then did two separate studies that showed, in fact, that there was a $250 billion tax break in this for the super rich, and it was taken out of the bill. But fundamentally, so many of these have happened, so many little favors where people have gone in and petitioned the government for a redress of grievances, which they have a right to do, and nobody has understood what's happening here, that collectively we are shifting the burden of taxes off the super wealthy and onto you and I.
So you say Congress writes bills that favor the rich. Why would they do that?
My theory, I call the political donor class theory, is that when you or I meet a congressman, it's for a handshake and a mall. Hi, I'm running for Congress. I hope you'll vote for me. But people who are important donors get to sit down and talk to their congressman, or they get to have people they've hired do it on their behalf.
The bottom line of your argument is that the extremely wealthy have ways to control how they report their income that ordinary wage earners ain't got.
That's exactly right. And there's no enforcement going on.
David K. Johnston. He's an investigative reporter for The New York Times and author of the book Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else. David, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us your town.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a new play opens in Chicago about the clergy sex abuse scandal.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The world's third largest oil company, Royal Dutch Shell, is under fire again. Back in January, the company shocked investors by reducing its estimate of proven oil reserves by 4 billion barrels, almost a fifth of its total. Now, the chairman has been fired, and a shareholder lawsuit accuses the company of shoddy accounting and severely overstating its real market value. Shades of Enron or not? Vijay Vaidyaswaram is energy correspondent for The Economist. Vijay, welcome.
Good to be here.
Let's start first with this oil. The oil that we're talking about is proven reserves. It's still in the ground. Shell has access to it. How could the company lose 4 billion barrels of these reserves overnight?
It doesn't look very good, does it?
No. Where does it go?
Well, it's about 20% of the company's entire reserve base. And if you don't look too carefully, it sounds like, you know, there's been some serious funny business that they somehow all these barrels disappeared. But in fact, under the accounting rules, companies can only book oil reserves as the category proven, meaning they're very, very likely to come to market, almost certainly. And what Shell has done is recategorized them as something called probable, which means they'll probably get to market a couple of years later at some point in the future. So the hydrocarbons still exist. The oil and gas hasn't gone away. There's no suggestion that you know, there was bogus assets being booked or anything like that, at least on current evidence. What Shell has said is that it's less likely to get to market than they had previously said.
Well, we're hearing from a lot of companies that they rebook their assets at the end of the year to determine which oil is more readily available than other oil. So how big was this in the eyes of the industry?
You're quite right to point out that rebooking itself is not a cardinal sin in the industry. What's astonishing about what's happening at Shell is the scale of the write-down. A fifth of an oil major's entire asset base, to have gotten it wrong, suggests that there is something seriously wrong at Shell. I mean, 2% is one thing, but 20%, that's eye-popping.
So what's the thinking of the industry? Is this just incompetence, a mistake? Is it malfeasance? And why, if it happened a year ago, why was the chairman just fired?
It's not yet clear. The details are yet to come out. But I think that we're likely to see a combination of overzealousness. I mean, the Phil Watts, who was chairman until recently, had always been thought of as a little over-eager to book reserves. One joke in the industry was that he booked his way to the top. He used to be head of exploration and production for the company, and therefore he certainly should have known what was going on and may well have been aware. And recent memos that have surfaced suggest that at least 2 years ago, perhaps earlier, he did know that there was a problem with how Shell was booking reserves. But there's a more systemic problem at Shell. Because Royal Dutch is a Dutch company and Shell, the other part of the company, is an English company, so you have a very unwieldy, bureaucratic kind of system where lots of funny business might take place without proper oversight.
Well, Vijay, the SEC is looking into this issue now. What happens next?
There's an internal audit at the company itself. There are suggestions that there may be more heads to roll even before the SEC audit is done. The real problem at Shell is not so much the specific oil and gas in question that was recategorized. Those are most likely to come back online. The real problem is, Shell isn't replacing its reserves as successfully as its rivals. All oil and gas companies debook or recategorize oil and gas. The difference is that they also book more than they take off the books, if you see what I mean. They find more oil and gas, and Shell has had a fundamental problem in the last 2 years in finding new oil and gas.
Vijay, thank you very much.
It's a great pleasure.
Vijay Vaidyaswaram, energy correspondent for The Economist and author of Power to the People, a book about the future of energy.
Tomorrow's presidential primary in Illinois isn't expected to win much national attention. President Bush and Senator Kerry should get the nod of their respective parties. But primary voters will also choose two candidates for U.S. Senate this fall. 7 Democrats and 8 Republicans are in the running. And if you think issues like, oh, say, Iraq, jobs, health care will have dominated, well, there's actually been a lot more heard lately about drug use, divorce, and even wife beating. We're joined now by Carlos Hernandez-Gomez, a political reporter for WBEZ in Chicago. Welcome, Carlos.
Thanks, Bill.
Carlos, this is not a campaign that's been dominated by issues. We hear of drug abuse. We hear of divorce. We even hear of wife beating, right?
Well, exactly. You know, of course, on the Democratic side, you've got Blair Hull, who was the early front runner, whose wife alleged in divorce papers that he called her vile names, punched her on the shin, and allegedly threatened to kill her. And that's, of course, garnered a lot of attention. And that's hurt Blair Hull in Chicago, but in the downstate areas, it has not hurt him that much because the story is not getting that much play. But in addition to that, the drug issue has come out on the Democratic side. Most of the candidates have admitted to either smoking pot or at some point in their youth doing cocaine. Blair Hull, who was the one-time frontrunner, admitted to being in rehab a few times. And some of them, particularly Barack Obama, who's currently the frontrunner on the Democratic side, has lamented the fact that it's become a race not really about issues, but about personalities and about drug use and divorces. And on the Republican side, you've got many of the Republican candidates attacking the frontrunner, Jack Ryan, because he has not released some documents from his divorce. Now, Jack Ryan says those documents are only relating to his son, which he says he will shield his son from harm. But the other Republicans say that there could possibly be some problems in those documents. Matter of fact, one of the other candidates' chief staffers alleged there were deviant sexual tendencies in those filings.
Jeez.
But there's been no proof of that thus far.
Now, any Senate race anywhere in the United States matters, with 51 Democrats to 48 Republicans to one independent in the closely divided U.S. Senate. Which way is it leaning for November, whoever wins this primary?
Well, I think it's the Democrats' show. I mean, if you look in 2002, Republicans made gains all over the U.S. In Illinois, Republicans got trounced. Democrats were out of the governor's mansion for 26 years. They recaptured the governor's mansion, recaptured all but one statewide office, and have control of both houses of the legislature and the state Supreme Court.
And who do you think the Democratic nominee will be? Who's leading at this point?
Well, Barack Obama is up in most polls by 20 or more points, but some of those poll numbers are soft. You have to understand there are problems sometimes in getting the African-American vote out. But Obama's support does extend beyond that. This is going to be a very interesting race in that the other leading candidate, Dan Hynes, who is the state controller, is the son of a powerful politician and has real machine support in Chicago. So the real question on the Democratic side is, can the machine deliver an election facing such a deficit in the polls for one of its favorite sons? And we're going to see that tomorrow.
In this primary election dominated more by scandal than issues, could that depress voters? voter turnout?
Well, it's going to be low, and I think that's what the organization wants. I think a lot of the party machinery, of course, is hoping the turnout, because when the turnout is low, at least in Chicago and in the state of Illinois, it makes it good for the organization. Certainly the weather's going to be good tomorrow, so that will certainly help. And the fact that the presidential has already been decided, that's certainly going to hurt turnout. But there are a bunch of referenda in Illinois throughout the Chicago area and across the state on many education issues, like, you know, stopping property tax caps and increasing the tax levies for schools. So that's going to bring out turnout, I think.
Tell us, for those of us not in Illinois, has there been a sense of outrage among voters that with all the important issues out there, it's become so dominated by scandal?
No. See, unfortunately, Bill, in Illinois, there really is a lack of moral outrage. It just doesn't exist. I mean, the last real moral outrage we saw in the state of Illinois was surrounding our former governor, George Ryan, who was recently indicted on federal corruption charges. And in Illinois, people are used to the average graft and corruption and dirty campaigning. It's happened forever. And, I mean, they become desensitized to it in some respects.
Carlos Hernandez Gomez is a political reporter for WBEZ in Chicago. Carlos, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
Still to come, there's more than country in Nashville. We'll explore rhythm and blues in Music City.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Remember Howard Dean? Once a harsh critic of rival John Kerry, Dean extended an olive branch to the Massachusetts senator last week. And yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press, Howard Dean praised John Kerry for winning fair and square. Well, on Thursday, Dean is expected to announce details of a new grassroots organization, and the Reverend Van Parker, for one, is curious to hear what he has to say. Reverend Parker is a 74-year-old volunteer, a Deaniac, one of thousands of Dean's supporters. He joins us on the line from his home in West Hartford, Connecticut. And Reverend Parker, what do you want Howard Dean to say on Thursday?
I'd like him to be himself. And I'd like him to announce what his new program is going to be. And I think it's going to be a program that involves supporting progressive candidates throughout the country. So I'm excited about it, and I'm certainly anticipating hearing more about it on Thursday.
When you say you want Howard Dean to be himself, what do you mean by that? Because some are wondering if he's losing the fire in his belly.
Well, I don't think he is. Howard Dean is a wonderful combination of a pragmatist and an idealist, which is something you don't see very often. I think he still has the same convictions that he's always had, but he has to work through the present structure, and that's what he's doing.
It's so funny you say he's a pragmatist. And you, as you well know, he was painted in the media as an angry man. Well, do you think that he was misrepresented somehow in the media?
I do. He's a person of honesty and conviction, and a person who has developed hope in people. Hope is the word that really characterized the Howard Dean campaign.
How do you feel about his coming out in recent days and praising John Kerry, his one-time fierce rival?
Well, I think he realizes, and has all along, that he and John Kerry have much more in common than they have differences. And even though Dean would take a different tack and perhaps be more forthright on certain issues like Iraq, he is definitely in the same ballpark with John Kerry and wants him to succeed.
What are you prepared to do now? I know that you knocked on doors during the New Hampshire primary and you actually hit the streets for Howard Dean. What are you prepared to do now?
Well, I did. I've had a Dean meeting in our home. I will continue to give financial support to the candidates he recommends.
Oh, the candidates he recommends. Because I was going to say, some would say that the time you're spending with Howard Dean right now is time you could be spending with John Kerry or a viable candidate.
Well, I think what Howard Dean has done is bring a backbone to the Democratic Party. Dean still needs to be heard, and his voice and his influence need to penetrate the bone and marrow of the Democratic Party.
In other words, you're prepared to do what Howard Dean tells you to do, and you anticipate that that is going to be supporting other candidates.
Well, I mean, if he tells me to do something truly outlandish, I wouldn't do it. But fundamentally, I agree with him, and I just find him and have found him a breath of fresh air.
Do you think he should run again at another time?
Oh, that's a good question. I honestly don't know. The vagaries of politics are very strange. I'd love to have him run again if the opportunity ever came out. I'm not sure it will. I certainly hope he will continue to have an influence, a leavening influence on the country and on the party.
Yeah, and as a Deaniac, what do you think of Ralph Nader's announced candidacy?
Nader is a good man in many ways, but I certainly hope he doesn't get much support. There may be a few that will support him, but I don't anticipate there'll be any large number. And Dean's strong support of Kerry will certainly help.
Well, Van Parker, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
The Reverend Van Parker spoke to us from West Hartford, Connecticut.
Stay with us. There's more ahead.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Johnny Cash, Hank Williams, Dolly Parton, the Grand Ole Opry, names that evoke men in black coats and women in sequins, gleaming leather cowboy boots and scruffy cowboy hats. It's all the look of the sound of Nashville, Tennessee. All-American country and western, which is by far the music most associated with Nashville. But this month, a new compilation CD and the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum highlight other genres that ring in Music City. Rhythm and blues, soul, gospel, even jazz.
Used to be young and handsome. Ain't it a doggone shame? A woman took all my money and left me standing in the rain. Nashville really jumping. Jumping all night long. I'd rather be in Nashville than to be way that home.
Here and Now music critic Tim Riley is in the studio to tell us more about the 18-month exhibit and the new compilation CD, Night Train to Nashville. Hey, Tim.
Hi, Bill.
So, Tim, let's get right to it. Night Train to Nashville. What's it all about? Give us something to listen to.
Well, it's one of these compilations that comes along every once in a while. It's really driven by an interesting idea, which is there's more to Nashville than country music. And what's going on this compilation is it's collected all the R&B and the soul and some of the jazz that was coming out of Nashville in the 50s and 60s that turns out to be really important and influential in another style of music that developed out of all of those, which is rock and roll. So the first song I've selected is by Arthur Gunter. It's a song called Let's Play House.
You may go to college, may go to school. You may get religion, baby, don't you be nobody's fool. Now, baby, come, come back, baby, I want to play house with you.
It's not quite country. It was recorded in Nashville.
It's a very informal recording session that took place in the back of Ernie's Record Mart, which was a Nashville record store. And Arthur Gunter laid down this track. And it does bear some definite country influence, I think you can hear in the singing. Well, of course, it charted number 12 on the R&B chart, but a few months after it came out, the young Elvis Presley recorded that same song in the Memphis studios, and it became one of his first national hits. So part of the appeal of this compilation is that it really is a diagram of exactly how rock and roll starts. You think about it, a black man doing an informal blues track in the back of Ernie's Record Mart in Nashville, and then Elvis Presley, a white truck driver from Memphis, singing that song and doing it in his own inimitable way. That's the beginning of rock and roll. So rock and roll really comes from all of these different strands sort of combining together, because these people are living in the same town and speaking a lot of the same languages and cross-pollinating all of these styles. And you can really get a vivid picture of how important both the blues and country music is to the formation of rock and roll.
Why is the album called Night Train to Nashville?
Well, Night Train was the name of a local TV show that aired in Nashville. And it was important because you used to only be able to hear R&B and soul and that kind of music on a local radio station called WLAC. And at nighttime, of course, the reach of that radio station was much further than the daytime, so a lot of people tuned in from far away to hear a lot of this music. But Night Train was one of these early regional TV shows where a lot of these performers who were passing through Nashville got exposure and people got a visual picture.
Someone who tuned into that station was Elvis Presley.
Elvis Presley would have definitely watched that. And, of course, it was the model for later shows like Soul Train.
Elvis, of course, from Memphis. Not every performer on this CD compilation is from Nashville.
Well, they take some liberties with that issue. Not everyone is from Nashville. Some of the people who appear here are passing through Nashville. Etta James released a record from a live set she did at a club in Nashville called Nashville's New Era Nightclub in 1960, and she sings Ray Charles's hit.
Hey, Chicago's Etta James covering Ray Charles' What I Say. Did they end up in Nashville because simply the recording equipment in that part of the country was there?
Sometimes they did. But the other curious thing about this compilation is that the liner notes are very good, and it details for you, you know, some of the people who played, who were backing up Etta James live when it wasn't her touring band or who were on her supporting bill. They were playing R&B in clubs at night, but they were doing session work for country musicians during the day. So the musicians were involved in this cross-pollination process almost, you know, directly.
There's a group on the CD called The Prisonaires, and they've got a story behind them.
The Prisonaires were formed by an inmate at the Tennessee State Penitentiary just outside Nashville, an inmate named Johnny Bragg, and he formed this vocal group, and they became so successful that the governor at the time, Frank Clement, would bring them out as part of his prison reform PR. He'd bring them to the governor's mansion to sing. And they traveled with a guard to Memphis one day in 1953 to record a song called Just Walkin' in the Rain. They recorded it, incidentally, at Sun Records in Memphis, just before Elvis Presley graduated from high school. And Johnny Ray later took the same song and had a hit in 1956 with it. This is Just Walkin' in the Rain.
Just walking in the rain, getting soaking wet, torture in my heart, by trying to forget, just walking in the rain.
There's always a certain poignancy to some of this music, isn't there? Because the black singers, soulful and wonderful as they are, didn't get rich off it.
No. Very few black singers, black acts, made much money off the records in the 50s.
And yet that's where so much of it is rooted.
Right. You know, what's interesting, again, is that this demonstrates how much listening was going on across racial lines. You know, you can tell from that lead vocal, you can tell how much country music that guy had absorbed in his life, and country phrasing, holding out notes, milking notes for all the sentimental value he can. And by the same token, a lot of country singers listening to a lot of the soul singers around at the same time.
Tim, what's the biggest surprise here? You listen to a lot of music.
Two things. I'll say the first is Arthur Alexander shows up on this compilation, which at first to me seemed like an anomaly. But Arthur Alexander, it turns out, is from Alabama. And he lived a lot of his life in the North and moved North. And actually, after he did most of his recording and stuff, wound up being a bus driver in Cleveland for a lot of the 70s. Mm. But he actually came back because critics really revered this guy, and he did a lot of really important songwriting. He actually died in Nashville. But the record company that picked up his stuff in the early 60s was the Dot Label, and they were located just outside Nashville. And the more I listened to him sing this song, Anna, which is one of his more famous songs, the more I realized he really did have a lot of country music in him. And you can sort of hear the subtext of this song as a very sentimental country number.
Anna, you come and ask me, girl, to set you free, girl. You say he loves you more than me. Well, I will set you free. Go with him. Go with him. But Anna.
The other thing that's fun about this compilation, it has a couple novelty items. It has a radio announcement, and it has a couple radio ads that are done. One by Little Richard, who does an ad for Royal Crown Hairdressing, 1956.
Slipping on a slide in Jean Noble with that good word on Royal Crown Hairdressing. Everywhere I go, and I go just about everywhere, the girls are really gone on Royal Crown Hairdressing. Even old Long Tall Sally use it. You know something, Jean? I goes for the girls with that Royal Crown look, because, man, she's got it.
Thanks.
Even Long Tall Sally uses it. Little Richard, making an extra buck. Hey, well, thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
The album is Night Train to Nashville. Our pop and rock critic is Tim Riley.
Sunny, yesterday my life was filled with rain. Sunny, you smiled at me and really eased the pain. Now the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
That's Bobby Hebb singing his 1966 song, Sunny, from the new box set, Night Train to Nashville.
Okay. Sunny, thank you for the love you brought my way.
you're all in all. And now I feel 10 feet tall. Sunny one, so true, I love you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
You let me see, Sunny. Thank you for the facts from A to Z. My life was torn like windblown sand. Then a rock was formed when you...
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.